episode of the Insights Podcast on the Acadia Broadcasting Network. I'm Don Mills.
And I'm David Campbell.
David, today we will be broadcasting the second of our two-part conversation with David Hawkins, the founder of Hawk Communications and a number of other businesses, by the way, including Brainworks and XYZ Communications. So a bit of a serial entrepreneur. And has been disproportionately a large figure in the field of marketing and advertising. In the second part of our conversation with David, we really focus more on the present and what's happening in that sector, and also a little bit about what he's doing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. David is a very interesting guy because he now introduces himself as a guy that's been working in the industry for over 50 years. And long after many people retire, David's been going strong. He's now in his mid-70s, I think, and still playing a role and still active. And I think that's a bit of a role model for me and others. And Don, you are too. This idea of retiring and Freedom 55 and heading off into the sunset is I think it was never a good concept. But now that I'm at that age, I understand.
Better reconsider the value of it, I guess. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
Well, yeah, so it's really interesting. So David actually, you know, I think about a year or so ago, sold his interest in Brainworks, which was his latest corporate activity, and decided that that was it for him. And guess what? He decided that it was not it for him, and he's now, again, re-engaged into, the business world again. Let's be honest, he can't give it up.
I'd say that's right. You know, I mean, he describes being, starting in the industry in the Mad Men era.
Yes.
And now he's already into the social media era. So it's, you know, that's a pretty interesting career path for him.
Yeah. You know, David is the kind of a guy that he should write a book because he knows so many of the main characters from a business and political world. He was involved a little bit on the political side. He was he worked with Frank McKenna and his administration, obviously. He just has a wealth of knowledge about our region and would be interesting for him to get that down on paper. And in fact, you know, because you and I have written a book, I'm gonna get him to write a book about this. It's just so, it's such an interesting story.
Well, he can use this interview as a place to start. He gives us a lot of good insight into his past, his history, his career, but also his insights on what's happening today.
Yeah, especially in terms of the advertising world, which has gone upside down since even the early part of this century in 2000. The role that big social media, you know, giants like Google and Meta are playing in terms of sucking up all the advertising dollars, leaving very little for traditional media, which is one of the reasons we're seeing, you know, newspapers and radio stations and, start to, you know, disappear. And there's a real question about what the future is for even things like, the news world. How are we going to collect news if there's no way of supporting that collection of news?
Well, he got pretty animated when we asked that question. And in fact, maybe not in the way that many of our listeners will think. So you'll have to tune in for that.
Yeah, I know. It gives a bit of a surprising answer to the question of what needs to be done. But anyway, here's our second part of a very interesting conversation with David Hawkins.
So, David, welcome back to part two of our extended interview. This is something we don't do with all of our guests, but because of the scope and the breadth of your career and all of the things you've been involved in, we thought we would take the time, and we appreciate you taking the time,
yep,
to do this over 2 weeks. We'd like to change the conversation now a bit and talk about the industry itself.
Yep.
You straddled all three sort of phases, all the way back to sort of getting ads in newspapers and, yep, I Love Lucy and, you know, through to the addition of the internet and now to TikTok.
Yeah.
So we'd like to ask you first about social media and the rise of social media. Mm-hmm. How has it changed how we do marketing and advertising these days?
Well, at the slightly humorous level, I go back to Mad Men. anyway. Oh, my gosh. Anyway, So social media, I mean, really, we're talking about digital media, because it depends on what you include in social media. Like, the reason I say digital media is because, you know, it just, it's a little more expansive. You know, there's an awful lot that can be accomplished over email. In fact, I was recommending to someone yesterday that they drop all their social media and run an email campaign. I said, you can target market. You can target market with email. And some people do that very, very effectively. So in any case, I'm probably drifting too far from the shore there, but let's be candid about it. Digital media, social media has kind of had ascendancy over the last, you know, Facebook, when I joined CCL or Color, Facebook had just started, right? And I can remember at Color, there were numerous people who were pushing back on it. And there was a couple of us who were saying, listen, this is the new thing. This is going to expand. It's going to advance. We had no idea at the time the extent to which it was going to advance and the impact it was going to have. But there were people, so that was, what was that, 2007, at CCL, who thought that it was going to bomb and who didn't want to invest in it at all. And so there was this huge divergence of, I mean, I hate to say it, but they were wrong, right? Terribly wrong. And it took them a long time to get up to speed, but they just didn't have the vision. They couldn't see it. They just didn't see this huge tidal change, right? So here we are today, and social media is in all of its components are dynamic. They're expansive. They have so many attributes in terms of ability to penetrate markets accurately, in a targeted way, economically, highly successful, and gain feedback instantaneously. Like you can track it. And you know, it used to be you run an ad, full page ad, and say the Toronto Star or the New York Times, and you really wouldn't know for some time whether or not that had been a waste of money or whether it had been a reasonable investment. And on social media, you know, you can track it in the next few minutes and you can track almost every dimension of it. So this is a magnificent tool, I would say, for communicators, marketers and communicators in almost anything they're doing. All kinds of challenges associated with it. And to be honest with you, I'm not an expert in social media. I don't pretend to be an expert. It's a diverse component of the communications business. It's changing all of the time. It's growing all of the time. And it has a lot of side effects, some of which are anticipated and some of which are not anticipated and rather distasteful or challenging. But it's not going away. That's one thing I would say. It's not going away. You probably are about to ask me, where do I think it's going? Gosh, I wish I had that crystal ball. but I don't. But you can be sure it's going someplace dynamic and that it's going to continue to grow in ways that we probably can't even imagine in this conversation. Yeah.
Yeah, I think if you stay healthy, David, you'll see the rise of the algorithms. It's already already driving it, and I think that'll be the dominant force in the years ahead. But I wanted to actually step back and ask you, one of the things that the legacy, all of the advertising, the sort of rise of that sector in the 70s, 80s, and 90s did was it provided the revenues for news, for hard news, for the actual kind of news that people need. And of course, as that revenue has left the legacy media and gone online, it's leaving sort of this core conversation about how we talk to each other in the news, the nightly news, the TV news, the radio news, the print media. Those are all under threat in the country. And the federal government is trying to force the tech giants who now dominate all of that revenue to give some of it back or to support in some way the legacy media. I guess I'd like you to just sort of weigh in on that whole side of the business. Do you think that the tech giant should be sharing more of that revenue? Do you think the government should be actually funding, you know, local news the way it's being done now? And there's a lot of controversy around that. Do you want to weigh in on that for our listeners? What do you think we should do on that front?
Yeah. Well, my first thoughts around that, and I realize that this may not be, how would I put it, acceptable to society. But I think going forward, consumers may simply need to pay for their news far more than they're used to. Now, the challenge with that is that in terms of news dissemination is that people are so not used to that. They're so used to getting news for what they deem to be free. It's not exactly free, but they would maybe see it as free. That, you know, are people prepared to pay for it? And so is there a news consumer out there? I don't know the answer to that, but there probably are a lot fewer of them. I'm quite happy to pay for my news. I have no problem with that, whatever. But I suspect I'm in the minority, and I suspect I may be in the serious minority. So I guess the question is, how do we keep society informed and engaged if they're not prepared to pay for, not just news, but, you know, engagement? Because, you know, reading the news is, I suppose, the entry level form of engagement, right? So I don't know the answer to that. It's a massive challenge, though. Now, the secondary question is, should, you know, are we in a position as a society to insist that should we as a society insist that the so-called tech giants effectively pay for news dissemination? I don't really see a rationale for that, personally. I mean, yes, that's a way to get it done, but I don't know that that's an ethical demand to make on companies who are not in the business of news generation or dissemination. I just don't know about that. That seems to me to be an intrusion asking. Well, let's not stop there. I guess you know what you really want my feeling is, well, let's not stop there. Let's not just ask the tech giants. Let's ask everybody. Actually, everybody's going to benefit from the news dissemination. Why should it just be Meta or Google? Like, I don't get it. Just because they destroyed the legacy business? Why should it be them? It should be everybody. Why shouldn't it be General Motors? Why shouldn't it be Volkswagen? Why shouldn't it be Sigma? Why just them? It seems to me we're kind of picking on them inappropriately. I don't find that to be very appropriate. So I guess the next question is it the government's responsibility to ensure the creation and dissemination of news? And it may be that that's the only choice. And then, so what happens is, then in fact, you and I are going to pay for it because it's going to come out of taxpayer revenue. But should that taxpayer revenue be specifically the tech giants? I don't see why that would be the case. I just don't see the argument for that. No. I mean, the government can make it that, but I think that's a gross form of discrimination against those companies. Really, really inappropriate. But that's my knee-jerk, probably very conservative response. I don't know if anybody aligns with that thinking. I haven't read too much about this topic, but that's how I feel about it. Yeah. And I don't mind saying, if you want your news, be prepared to pay for it. And if you don't want your news, well, you're going to have a different society than you're used to or than you grew up with. Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
So I want to change the topic for a second, David. In 2015, you were inducted into the New Brunswick Business Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Not only for your business success, but also for your significant contributions to the community through your volunteer work. Uh-huh. What did that recognition mean to you and your family?
Well, Don, I'll tell you something. So a lot of that recognition really, I suppose, was associated principally with the achievements that Hawk Communications made over the years, not exclusively, but I would say largely. And, you know, we did a lot of volunteer work using the resources of Hawk Communications. We, over the years, donated about $5 million. We did about $7.5 million of pro bono work, which would have added to that awareness of Hawk and the stature that Hawk had, and so forth. So I never saw that as a personal thing. To me, it was recognition of the company and everybody who had participated in it. And so to me, it was recognition of our employees, our clients, our suppliers, the community in which we operated, because we couldn't have done any of that without all of those people. So, I was just one person. I mean, really, so that was my own personal point of view about it. And I don't mean that, I wouldn't want that to sound like I'm being inappropriately humble. That's just my point of view about it. It's as simple as that. I did not personally achieve, or how would I put it? I did not achieve any of those things on my own. I was there along with quite a number of other people. And I can tell you, and I would have achieved nor have been part of any of that without my wife, Lori. And right. And I am.
Yeah, we're going to come back to your wife in a second, because
I'm just extremely aware of that, right? It took an entire team. And part of that team, as I said, was, you know, we had the support of a lot of clients. We had this, we really did, you know, and those early clients, whether it was Loblaws, Mount Allison University, McCain, Sabian, we would have got nowhere without them, nowhere. So they had a lot of faith and belief in us, and it allowed us to invest in the company, to expand the company. It gave us the resources to make philanthropic donations, to do pro bono work. And that's just a simple reality, right?
So during your time in the marketing and advertising business, you've seen a lot, met a lot of people. Uh-huh. Who did you most admire, either as a colleague or as a competitor?
Well, I had a lot of admiration for you and Steve, I have to tell you. I really did. And I saw you folks and what you were doing, and had just a lot of admiration for your leadership in the industry and the what I consider to be the great work that you did. And I don't mind saying that I aspired to do work of a similar quality and have similar results. So I wanted to say that right out loud, if for no other reason than it's just the plain truth, right? And so that's
very kind of you.
Yeah. Well, that's I'm just telling it like it is for me. You know, beyond that, I don't mind saying that I had, this is kind of outside the industry, but I had then, and I still do have, this enormous depth of respect for Wallace and Harrison McCain. I really can't tell you how deep that goes with me. You know, you look at Florenceville, 752 people, and back then and still, and you know, they're probably going to hit $12 billion this year in all of their markets. that's quite an accomplishment by anybody's standards, and certainly by Canadian standards, and certainly by New Brunswick standards. So that's a rather remarkable achievement. And, you know, I have a similar kind of admiration for what Casey Irving did and what his boys did and continue to do. It's their achievement and contribution is, I just think, far more than most people are aware. And, you know, people love to hate wealth, power, and privilege. And those people I've mentioned have a lot of wealth, power, and privilege, but they earned every bit of it. A personal hero of mine is John Bragg. So I've known John for over 40 years. And John has a standard that is pretty extraordinary. And as a human being, as a business person, John's the real thing, right? So, so those are the people that come to mind for me. I know those are big names. I get, you know, we're talking about billionaires, but they weren't always billionaires. They earned it. They just did. And again, people love to hate wealth, power, and privilege, but that's one thing I don't discriminate against. I know those people. I know them personally, and they earned it. They absolutely earned it. And yes, in everybody's life, there are things that they probably wouldn't do again, probably mistakes that they've made or toes that they've stepped on here and there. But I don't think it was their intention. I think it was more the outcome of them trying to live into their vision. And their vision in the context of the Maritimes at the time and today, and in the context of Canada, was rather extraordinary. Hawk Communications was a tiny little company in a tiny little town in, frankly, a tiny little province. And we had the benefit of doing business with all of those people, and it was a huge, huge privilege to work with them, to know them. Their doors were always open to me and still are. No one ever said no to me, ever, not once. If I want to get a meeting with any of the people I've mentioned, some of them aren't living any longer, but their children or grandchildren, I can do that. So what does that say about them, right? They're there to serve too. They're there to serve also, and they continue to do that. And I know that not everybody sees it that way, but that you asked me, and that's the way I see it. So, I get that that's unpopular with some people. I don't care if it's unpopular with some people. That is the way I see it. And I feel very, very strongly about that. Yeah.
So I've been trying to get Allison McCain to come on this podcast for the last 2 years. So maybe you can,
help us.
You can twist his arm. He's one of the few that we haven't been able to get on. So,
well, listen, I know Allison quite well. I've met with him twice in the last 3 weeks, and, I'll speak to him about that, because I think Allison can tell a story from a perspective that I think would be, you know, very, very helpful and informative. Have you had Scott on?
He's on our list, though, and I've talked to Scott, and I will have him on for sure.
Yeah. So you'll get two different stories there, probably, or from two different perspectives, but both will be valuable. Yeah. Those are two very, very fine people, really.
Yes.
They're wonderful, wonderful human beings. Yeah.
So we wanted to shift gears a little bit and talk about your volunteer activities. In fact, that's really where I knew you most from, David. Right. I mean, you've been, ever since I knew you, you've been volunteering for community events, for philanthropic activities. And most recently, you led this campaign to raise, you know, a tremendous amount of money to support Ukrainian refugees in the Moncton area. I don't know what that ended up being, but it was $1 million or $2 million, a big amount of money. So I guess the first question for you on that is, what volunteer roles over these many years have you been most proud of? Now, you did talk about the Beaujolais work, which I think is a really great example, but give us another couple of examples.
Oh gosh. There's quite a list, and you know, I've been particularly focused around volunteer work that is associated with social services, but not exclusively. So I was really one of the founders of the Northrop Frye Festival and did a lot of work on that in the early years with Paulette Thériault and Darn Arnold and Suzanne Cyr and quite a host of others. And so that, you know, the Frye Festival is ongoing and has contributed a lot to the cultural community. I did a lot of work, which I think worked out very well with the Beaverbrook Art Gallery over quite a number of years. And, you know, that all worked out pretty well. And I don't know if anybody's been up to the Beaverbrook lately, but it's quite something. And so those are two in the arts and culture sector that overlaps with quite a bit of volunteer work that I did with in higher education with Mount Allison University, Crandall University, UNB. And for that matter, Université de Moncton. So that's in the education sector. And then specifically in social services, well, I mentioned the Courage campaign, and it's now called the Centre Courage. So that's been great. We did a lot of work in the YWCA in establishing the whole new center there. And again, that's kind of a social service thing. The Hospice Greater Moncton was another. There's been a lot of them, David. And I think the way I feel about it, is that our communities run over top of volunteer work to a considerable extent, and much more so than people are aware of. And if all of a sudden today, all the volunteers stop volunteering, I would say the community would come close to a halt. So it would be hard to run the hospitals. It would be very difficult for any of these cultural things to take place. The staggering amount of sports activities that take place over top of volunteer activities. So to me, it's just a way of investing in the communities in which we live. And so people can say, well, that's not quite it, but I think it is it. You know, people volunteer in order to, the primary beneficiary, the initial beneficiary is themselves, right? And so nobody is a philanthropist or volunteer without themselves being the first beneficiary. So if somebody were to say, David, why have you done all of this philanthropic and volunteer work? I know what my answer is. It's really a simple answer. It's to send myself a message that I'm a reasonably decent human being. That's the primary message. And I'm not going to lie about that, because if I didn't get that benefit, I don't think I'm so generous that I would do it. And so it sends me that message. And I'd like to make that statement about myself, and I don't mind if others observe it. And so it sends a message to other people about the kinds of activities and contributions that they too can make and how important those are. So there's some role modeling in that, right? I can remember when we made our first donation to Mount Allison University was 1989. It was $50,000. And I can tell you, $50,000 was a lot of money to Little Hawk Communications at that time. And Harvey Gilmore, who was the head of development there at the time, I said, Harvey, I'd just like to do this anonymously. And he said, I don't want you to do that. I said, well, Harvey, maybe you didn't hear me. I want to do it anonymously. And he says, no, I don't accept that. He said, you need to send a message to all of the other people in this community who can make contributions to Mount Allison. You need to role model that, David. Well, I didn't want to role model it. I really, really didn't, but I did. And so I said, well, fair enough. Don't use my name, just use the company's name. And we did that. And one of the results of that is there was another company in town that contributed a similar amount. They went up from 10,000 to 50,000. Well, they were a much bigger, better finance company than we were. And I think they thought, geez, if that Mickey Mouse little company up the street can do 50, well, so can we. So, you know, you can see how that role modeling works. And I, you know, I do a lot of fundraising, and I say that to people all the time. People are very humble or whatever, reticent in some cases to, you know, there are philanthropists out there who don't see it as public relations. It's not a public relations campaign for them making donations. It's not. That what they're doing is making a contribution to the community. They're not making a contribution to their own reputation. And so you have to quite often encourage those people to become more public about it, because it's very, very helpful to the organizations that we're trying to raise money for. So I don't know why I'm telling you all that, but I am.
No, I appreciate it, David. We appreciate it. So we want to turn now to politics. Of course, that's another area that you've been involved with over the course of your time in New Brunswick. You've had a keen interest in provincial politics.
Right.
And you were known to work with liberal governments. At least that's what Don has written here in the question list. So can you give us a sense of your opinion of the current political environment in New Brunswick and maybe the rest of Atlantic Canada? So what's going on these days from your perspective?
Yeah. Well, my gosh, that's a big, big topic. I was a significant supporter of Frank McKenna's for a number of reasons. Quite candidly, like so many others, I love Frank's energy and leadership. Frank was very optimistic. He had a very can-do attitude, and it really aligned with many of the values that I believed in at the time and still do. And I'm still a big supporter of Frank. So that's where kind of my political involvement, as they say, maybe started. I was also very aware that when you get 58 out of 58 seats, you're going to be in power for a while. And it was just smart from a business point of view to align ourselves with whoever was going to be in power for a while. And it turned out liberals were in power for 12 years, from 87 to 99, right? So it was just, you know, in a way it was good business. And we did a fair bit of business with the provincial government while Richard Hatfield was in power. So it wasn't, you know, people thought we just got that support from the provincial government for political reasons, but we didn't. We bid projects. We were low bid, or we were the best bid, and that was how that involvement kind of came about. So, just shifting gears a bit, I personally kind of like New Brunswick's premier in a number of ways, and I particularly like his fiscal approach to things. You know, he's not a person that wastes money or spends money frivolously. He likes to see results, and he likes to be careful with the resources that are available. He takes an awful lot of heat around that topic. And frankly, I think it's astonishingly naive and disrespectful. And how would I put it? Lacking in a sense of practicality when people criticize him on that level. Now, there's a whole bunch of social things that he has done, and I haven't tracked them all, nor have I stayed close to it, that I probably wouldn't be in alignment with Higgs about. But I think he's an awfully good person that tries hard and is trying to do the right thing and live by his standards, and it's hard to fault someone for doing that. And you know, you only get to vote for the people who raise their hand and are prepared to put up with the political environment. And he's a person that's done that. It's a bit of a thankless job. People just continuously love to hate their politicians, right? So in the current environment, you know, I think there's a possibility that there'll be a change of government. I don't know. You know, Susan is a wonderful person, has so many attributes. I'm not entirely sure that New Brunswick is ready for a female premier. I don't know that they aren't, but this is a very conservative environment, and I'm just not sure they are. I'd love to see the research on that, and the research would probably tell you the story. But we're probably due for a change, and frankly, I hope Susan does well, and I see no reason why she shouldn't, other than I'm just not sure that a very conservative electorate are ready for it. So I don't have too much more to say about politics than that. I haven't been tracking it carefully for a while. I have a lot of admiration for our politicians, and just for the fact that they're prepared to do a very tough job that most people don't want to do. It would be awfully nice if we could attract a high standard of candidates, which is becoming increasingly difficult because the electorate is so challenging to deal with. I think, you know, one of the things that Frank McKenna did back in 87 is he went around the province and very carefully handpicked his candidates. And it's one of the reasons that his government was so strong, is that he had candidates who left their careers as doctors and in some cases lawyers and educators and other things, because they believed in his vision and what he was doing. And so this is so critical that you're able to recruit people of high caliber. So I noticed, as an example, Susan Holt, directly or indirectly, was able to recruit David Alston to run in the St. John area. Well, David's a very capable person, and David's a hardworking person, and David has very high standards. And there aren't a lot of people in politics today that can, you know, live up to the, or do live up to the standards that David puts forth. I'm not saying there are none, but so more candidates of that caliber are going to be very, very helpful to the future of New Brunswick. When you look across the Maritimes, and this may be an old argument that is no longer worth voicing, but there just has to be more cooperation between the four Atlantic provinces. Somehow or other, we need to blend our efforts and focus in a more effective way than we have in the past or than we are currently doing at present. It's a lot of wasted energy and effort and resources.
Yeah, we would agree with that, David. Atlantic Canada is a region in transition. It's really largely driven by population growth, as you know. But, you know, I want to ask you, what, in your opinion, must the region do to take advantage of the economic momentum that we are currently enjoying?
Yeah. Well, this may not be quite on point, but when I arrived in New Brunswick 50 years ago this June, one of the observations I made the day I got off the bus, so to speak, was that, and I, you know, I was coming from Montreal, which had a pretty diverse population. You know, I had grown up with and gone to school with large populations of immigrants who were a dynamic, very dynamic part of Montreal, economically, creatively, culturally. And I didn't see any of that in the Maritimes 50 years ago. So we're seeing a lot more of that now, not a staggering amount more, but a lot more. And I think that, and I know from research that we did 10, 12 years ago, actually with you, Don, that this was not the most welcoming place in Canada for immigrants, and we need to be the most welcoming place, because we need that energy and creativity and thrust that immigrants can put into the economy and want to put into our communities. So I think in order to tap into the, and you know, a lot of the, not all, but a lot of the inflow or population growth is coming from immigration. Well, you could say it all is, but a lot of it's coming from other parts of Canada, right? It's not all coming from overseas. I'm not sure what the numbers are. But do you know, David, like how many people entering Atlantic Canada are coming from other parts of Canada compared to other parts of the world? Is it probably 60-40, something like that?
That's a pretty good breakdown, 60-40. Of course, before the pandemic, it was even a higher share immigrants, right, in terms of net interprovincial, but the pandemic accelerated movement from the other parts of Canada. So it's, I'd say 60-40 is a good split.
Yeah. So, you know, these are people who have come here because one way or the other, they see a better future for them here. So we need to make very, very certain that we embrace everything that they bring to the table in whatever ways we can. They've chosen, as I did. I didn't grow up here. I chose to live here. And, you know, I often say this to people who grew up in the Maritimes. I'll sit in a room with 12 or 14 people. I'll scan the room and I'll realize I'm the only person who chose to live here. And I'll have to make that with these people. I'll make that point with these people. I don't mean it in a prejudicial or critical way. I'm just saying there's a little bit of a difference between my attitude and yours, because I saw this as the place for improving my life and my future. I saw this as a place of opportunity. And so many of the people who grew up here that I sit around the table with, they have a different perspective on it. They often think, gee, I wish I'd moved to Montreal. I wish I'd moved to Vancouver the way my brother did. They just don't see it. They don't see the opportunity here. Like, I don't mind saying, and this may sound a little self-aggrandizing, but Laurie and I did not build Hawk Communications on the basis of thinking there was no opportunity in Sackville, New Brunswick, or in the Maritimes. We obviously just didn't see it that way, right? And so, so the people who are moving here, whether they're coming from Afghanistan or Syria or Vancouver, those are people who see an opportunity here that perhaps the incumbents don't fully see. And we need to make sure that we embrace that fully, because I think there's a lot of energy in that. You know, It was 1982. I was working on an initiative in and around Sackville. It wasn't going anywhere. This is going to sound a little critical, okay? And that's fine. But it just wasn't going anywhere. I had someone who you'd know, someone who was a fairly big name in Atlantic Canada, called me up and he said, you know, David, you should stop working on that project. It's not going to go anywhere. He said, you're trying to light a fire with wet wood. And one thing I learned about getting things done in the Maritimes, start with dry wood. He said, so you need some partners that represent dry wood. And he said, right now you're so what he was talking about was the attitude of the people that I was, trying to get things done with, frankly, in southeastern New Brunswick at the time. This was a Maritimer. This was a Maritimer speaking to me, telling me, find some other Maritimers who represent dry wood and who are ready to start a fire with you. Stop talking to these. Stop trying to convince these people. So Don, when we did that research a few years ago on immigration, and we found out that so many Maritimers weren't that welcoming to immigrants, okay? I'm sorry, but those are dry. That's dry wood. Dry wood, right? And some of that was the provincial governments. Some of that was the provincial governments, right? So we need to find a way to kiln dry the wood.
you just mentioned your wife Lori, who passed away this last summer, uh-huh. She was not only your life partner, but your business partner. You obviously had a very special relationship, David, with her. Tell us a little bit about Lori and how important she was in your life and career.
Yeah. So I have three complete meltdowns a day. I'm going to try to avoid that right now. Well, it's hard to talk about your spouse when they're gone, right? Anyway, since Lori passed, I've come to realize many things. And one is that, you know, there never would have been a Hawk Communications without her. You know, most businesses have a lead person who's visible and at the front of the business. Typically, they're working on business development and things like that, or they're working with clients. And that was me. But, you know, behind the scenes, you know, Lori was keeping the home fires burning. And if she hadn't been there to do all of that, the house would have froze, right? So, and that was also true of, you know, people that we hired over the years. And, you know, when we exited Hawk, Lori had 38 people that reported to her. It was more than half the company. And she would never have been celebrated for managing all those people as well as she did. She was so humble, so self-effacing, so unassuming, so quiet, and so kind. You know, she just was the opposite of people like me who were kind of out front and in front of the microphone and on the stage, right? So she and a number of other people were the mainstays of the company, and she was absolutely the mainstay of my life. She was astonishingly stable. I don't think I saw that all those years, Don, to the extent that it impacted me in a very positive way. Just, you know, things could get pretty riled up inside an ad agency at times, and mm-hmm. she never got riled up. I don't know how she did it. Honestly, I have just no idea. It is astounding to me looking back. And I guess some people are just like that, right? And can make those contributions. So it's a big void in my life. It would have been a much, anyway, I would have, we wouldn't be having this discussion you wouldn't be interviewing me if it hadn't been for her. That is a simple fact, and I know it. I don't think I'm exaggerating at all in saying that. I think that's just a simple fact. Yeah.
I'm very glad to bring her into this story.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah. Appreciate that.
So David, I have to ask you about economic development. It's uh-huh. my passion. It's what I've spent 30 years thinking about. And you and I have actually talked about this before. Mm-hmm. I want to know your thoughts as to why the industry you're in, marketing, communications, public relations, has shrunk the GDP contribution in New Brunswick.
Yeah.
Since the time you sold Hawk, it's dropped by about the GDP contribution has dropped by about 35%. It's actually grown in Nova Scotia and it's grown strongly in Ontario. So what is going on in New Brunswick that we can't get more juice out of that sector here?
Well, I think I know why. And I'll tell you what one of the reasons is. Well, you need some drivers for one. So obviously there were people at Hawk Communications, myself, Carol Chapman, you know, Steve McKinnon when he was there, and others who were drivers of the business, right? They wanted to expand the business and make it grow and happen. So that's one factor. But I'll tell you another huge factor is that, generally speaking, well, let's look at it this way. Lori and I reinvested roughly 92% of every cent we ever made back into Hawk Communications. Financially, economically, that probably wasn't a good decision. We probably would have been better off keeping a lot more of that money for ourselves. However, that's what we did, okay? So the result of that is that we had the latest equipment, the most efficient equipment. You could call it the best factory. We hired extremely good people. We paid them well. We incented them well. We motivated them well. We were prepared to take risks. And I haven't seen anybody in New Brunswick that has even come close to that in the last 30 years. And I didn't know that. I had not observed that until about 5 years ago. And I thought, why isn't so-and-so expanding their business? So I went and spoke to them. And they would say things to me like, well, if we were to do that, you know, we'd have to spend $30,000 on new equipment. Well, in 1988, we spent $1.2 million of 1998 money on new equipment, and we spent the same amount in 1999. I don't know anybody else who would do that. So you just had to be prepared to invest in these businesses. The other thing is they would say, well, I would look at their businesses because they would call me and they would have trouble, right? Competitors would have trouble. They call me and they say, look at this. And I say, well, you guys need a line of credit. The reason you're out of money is because you've got all these accounts receivable and, you know, you just got some slow payers. And they say, well, we don't want to take the risk on a line of credit. Well, our line of credit in 1992 was $3.2 million in 1992. So that's probably $6 million today. So I would say one of the reasons the business is constricted is people aren't prepared to take on the risk. So I don't mean to sound critical. I'm just being observational. Okay. I can tell you that BrainWorks wouldn't have had a hope in heck of growing the way it did had Lori and I not financed it. Not a chance. We just wouldn't have had the money. And so we were prepared to take on significant lines of credit to invest in extremely expensive equipment. That's one of the reasons we did as well as we did. But if you've got people who are running businesses, making good money, and they want to put all the money into their pockets or pay off their mortgage or go to Florida for 2 months, well, good luck, right? It's just not going to work that way. Sorry. It's not the way business is working. I'll tell you something. The Irvings don't do that and the McCains don't do it either. So,
I actually don't think there's a lack of creative people around. I meet a lot of creative people, but I don't know that they have the business savvy maybe that you and Lori brought to the table.
Or the preparedness to take on the risk. We may have been very naive. We may have taken on that risk in a very naive way without really fully thinking it through. And all I'm saying is we did it. So if we took on a line of credit, say for $3.2 million, who was that with? Well, our clients were McCain's, Irving, Ganong, Moosehead. They were going to pay us. You know, they were going to pay us. We knew we were going to get paid by them. So it wasn't really a lot of risk. Tourism New Brunswick, they were going to pay us. So it may have seemed like a lot of risk, felt like a lot, but if your risk profile is, we'll take on $25,000 of risk, well, you couldn't do the work. It's as simple as that. You couldn't do the work, right?
So I want to ask you about retirement. Most people retire at 60 or 65, and they spend their winters in Florida playing canasta and lawn bowling. You went in a different direction.
Yeah.
You've been very active, and as we understand it, you're in your mid-70s now and still going strong, kind of retired from BrainWorks, but still active.
Yeah.
So why has it been so important to you to continue working well beyond the period that most people retire?
I think it's a couple of things, and you're going to have to edit what I'm going to say. I need to exit this fairly quickly. I have an appointment downtown. Anyway, okay, so David, to start over, to answer your question, I think that, you know, I've really worked most of my life. It's what I do. It's what I'm happy doing. It's my way of being of service. So I think those are the two factors for me. If I have a choice between playing golf on Wednesday afternoon or helping a client advance their goals, I'll probably choose the client. I'm just kind of built that way. I'm not saying it's a good thing, but it's just the way I am, right? So, I don't work anywhere near the extent to which I used to, and I'm not pretending that I do, but I do like being active. It's very stimulating to the mind, right? And you feel like you're getting something done. There's a sense of accomplishment. It's no more pretty basic needs, right? Being fulfilled, yeah.
Don, I'll let you ask one more question because we have to let Dave go.
Yeah, the final one that I'd really like to ask is, what advice do you have for young people interested in starting their own business, David?
Well, one of them I voiced a bit earlier, and that was be awfully certain that you take in more money than you spend, and pay. Don't be silly about that, particularly in the initial years. It's such a tough question, Don, because, you know, everybody's kind of unique and individual. You know, I think most people in business that succeed have some strong sense of purpose. They feel that they're doing something that's worthwhile. And so I think you need to be aligned with an activity that's meaningful to you and that hopefully is meaningful to a customer base that is prepared to put you in a position where you take in more money than you spend. And I don't know what else to say about that. You know, we were never in business just to make money. It was just never our focus. Making money was the byproduct of everything we did. And so, and I realize there's plenty of people out there who making money is the reason they're in business. It's the only reason they're in business. And some people seem to excel with that. They're okay with that. But there was entire categories of business that I refused to service, right, in Hawk. And they were big categories of business. So I'm not fond of promoting lotteries, as an example. I'm quite candidly not fond of promoting beverage alcohol, just as an example. I just assume someone else did that. So it just doesn't align with my sense of purpose or contribution. And I'm not opposed to other people doing it. I'm not opposed to people drinking and not opposed to people, you know, buying lottery tickets. It's just, it's not something I want to promote. It's nothing more or less than that. So it wouldn't be a contribution that was meaningful to David.
Well, on that note, we'll end it. So thank you so much for joining us on the Insight Podcast for an extended interview that spread over 2 weeks. We do appreciate that, providing us an overview of your long and successful career. And we wish you all the best. I'm sure there'll be a next chapter, and we wish you all the best in that chapter.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
And I just want to add, David, that you are a legend in the marketing and advertising world in this region, and you've made an enormous contribution to your province that I'm sure most people do recognize. So thanks for joining us on the podcast.
You've been listening to the Insights Podcast from the Acadia Broadcasting Corporation. Follow the show and listen to past episodes on your favorite podcast platform like Apple or Spotify. If you've enjoyed the show, why not recommend it to a friend? Don and David will be back next week with another deep dive into some key issues in Atlantic Canada.